Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. This is a very special show. Every week, I try to explain to my listeners exactly what's going on in the medical profession from a physician's point of view. I'm in solo practice, and I have an office-based practice, 99% of it. And I wanted to get a take from somebody who is on the front line and can explain and give us a really insider view of what's going on from the hospital side of our healthcare system. I don't think anybody is under the illusion anymore that our healthcare system is going in the wrong direction, that it's being centralized, corporately controlled, and the government is putting everything they have in basically micromanaging our healthcare system from the doctor standpoint and from the patient standpoint. And this is real important information so that you can understand exactly what's going on between the doctor and the hospital, which is just, it's unseemly, to put it mildly. And I'm talking today with Dr. Gene Doria. He is a physician who practices in California. And if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Doria, you are in geriatrics. Is that correct?
I thank you for having me on the show today. Yes, I am in geriatrics, and I have a solo practice in Santa Clarita. Mm-hmm. I've been here for almost 30 years, and most of my practice is house calls. So even though I have an office, and I see a few patients in the office, most of my my patients are homebound. About 40% now are bedridden. So I've been doing house calls for the entire time that I've been in Santa Clarita, but it's become because there are so many patients out there in need and can't get to the office, I have been relegated the duty of doing house calls, which I love because it gives me an integral view of how our seniors are living and what their true needs are.
And I think that they're the most at risk patient pool in our country at this point. They are at the mercy of Medicare. They're at the mercy of doctors who, I think the training of physicians has completely changed since I graduated, where the patient is almost seen as an enemy, a cost center, and something to be managed and removed so that you can get to the next person and save money. I've been following your blogs for quite a while, and every time I read one, I just get completely, riled up, partially, but also really amazed that you are able to expound and really explain exactly what's going on. It's so complex that I think most people would just, in our show today, we're going to discuss a lot of this so that people can get a feeling, a flavor of how hard it is to be an advocate for your patients. I think it's awesome that you do house calls. That means you're keeping patients out of a system that, to me, seems to be working against them. So in your 30 years, what do you think is, how is this affecting you from a physician standpoint, from a human standpoint? What are you seeing on the front line right now?
Well, certainly it's been made more difficult. There is no doubt the interjection of the rules of government have played a huge role in how I'm able to practice. But it also has allowed those who might want to take advantage of the system to take advantage, especially of our seniors. Mm-hmm. And because I'm allowed to have the continuity of care of not only seeing the patient in their home, but I'm also allowed the ability to see them in the hospital setting all the way to end of life. because I'm able to see that, I also see the impact that that all these rules and regulations have allowed the hospital administrations to take and push our seniors, especially our elder seniors, into situations where they are not allowing them to get over the hump of some illness. Mm-hmm. They're allowing them to be pushed into palliative then hospice care and shooing them out of the hospital so the hospitals can make money. It's become an enterprise of profit against our seniors especially. But, you know, I think on the lower level of private insurance, that has become another source where those who want to have been allowed to take advantage of our patients and make their profit. And it's made it much more difficult, like doctors like myself, to be able to practice the way we want to. There's so much interjection of telling us while our patients are hospitalized, your length of stay is too long, you can't give these medicines or you can't provide this treatment. And the decision making of how we're caring for our patients is slowly being removed by especially profiteers that say, you know, sorry, patient, you're not going to get the care that we feel, the doctors feel is necessary because we want to make our money.
Absolutely. And I want to go back in time a little bit to how and why. Why you just described why, because I think it's about money as well. But how did the administration become so powerful? Go back to when you first started practicing. The doctors, when you admitted a patient, you control the medical course of your patient. Everything had to go through the doctor who admitted the patient. That's how I remember when I was a medical student practicing. You know, whatever the attending said, we carried forth. There were no hospitalists. There were no nurse practitioners and doctor nurses in our system. How do you think, and am I wrong, did it start from that and then morph into what you just described?
Well, I think it was intentional. It was a morphing that came through the profit motive. And don't forget, Elena, that what was done before may have not been the best way of doing things. You know, there were some unscrupulous colleagues of ours mm-hmm. who took advantage of the system as well, and they did make it to a certain degree inefficient. But because of that, probably around 20 years ago, if you recall, the system, there were a lot of hospitals that were going into bankruptcy. They were having financial problems. Overspending was abounding, and you know, some of the things that were being done were just a little bit beyond what should have been done. Well, to bring that, to harness that and put the reins on it and say we're going to control it, you know, there's a lot of conjecture and I believe a reality that there was a setup of hospital administrators from the American Hospital Association with lawyers who put a plan, game plan together that started to template all of the things that they wanted to do to control the hospital setting. Mm-hmm. And they have done that now. That's gone from 20 years ago to a little over 10 years ago to implementing it. And then because of all the rules and the laws and loopholes that they were able to put together, they were able to take care bring in the medical decision-making that we as doctors used to control and allow them to start making those decisions. So they started to use the statistics and the computers to our disadvantage and, of course, to our patients' disadvantage to essentially give us cut-rate care.
Well, I'm seeing the rhetoric, you know, in terms of the medical students and what they're taught and what's coming out of the bioethicists that, and I'm sure you've heard this too, most of the money spent in healthcare is spent on the last few months of life, and that's the area that we need to control because it's screwing up and skewing the whole system towards paying too much for healthcare. That seems to me to be the red herring, the thing that's driving the dropping the floor on health care for everybody. Is that their meme? Is that what they're trying to use to make everybody get in line with, hey, it's okay to kill grandma because she's costing us too much money, everybody too much money?
Absolutely. And, you know, the biggest impact comes on patients who are in the intensive care unit setting.
Mm-hmm.
If you are very ill, now, remember, Elena, I'm a primary care physician. And as a primary care physician, I bring grandma in, mm-hmm. and she's very sick. It doesn't mean that it's end of life for that patient, though. It doesn't mean that grandma doesn't have any more options. And in the past, we would be able to get the patient over their problem and maybe not see them back in a hospital setting for 10 or 20 years. So we would get them through that. These are just bumps and humps in the road,
mm-hmm.
that they could, medically, we can get them through. But now, everybody who comes into the intensive care unit, at least at our hospital, which is a nonprofit hospital and the only one in our community, everybody who comes in who's a senior, the first thing they try to do is get the patient on palliative care with a segue into hospice. Everybody gets that kind of treatment. And that's been I have been trying to alert our physicians to, not allowing that to happen. Certainly, there's no doubt that the cost of medicine in the last few months of life is high. But it doesn't mean that you suddenly cut those patients off and don't give them a chance or an opportunity to survive when indeed they want to.
Mm-hmm.
There are some patients who have terminal illness, cancers, and, you know, we take that into account. But many of those patients even say, hey, I still have quality of life. I'm still driving even.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still interacting with my family and my community. Those people should be allowed an option to survive if given that option. But I have seen at our hospitals those options eliminated. I have seen especially some of the HMO type of physicians say, not providing all the options that a patient can have and opportunities to survive. And, you know, we are a society that looks at the bottom line now. I have no problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's important that we don't overdo in situations where there's no opportunity for survival. But, you know, Elena, in being a primary care doctor, probably a very less than 10% of my patients who enter the ICU don't go home. Greater than 90% of my patients do go home and reestablish their quality of life. And that's the bottom line. Shouldn't be the cost that's the bottom line. It should be the quality of life that our patients will sustain if they are given the opportunity. But nowadays, you know, we're being propagandized. Grandma's costing too much money. Therefore, let's terminate her.
There's no empathy with it. I practice medicine, old-fashioned medicine, like you do, and you're exactly right. It's about the quality of life. It's about the wishes of the patient and the patient's family. They seem to be cut out of it. I've seen or heard of instances where you get admitted to the hospital, you have a living will, and you come in and somebody else just abrogates a living will. I mean, so what? You have one. Our bioethics panel decides that you're not viable, and we're going to offer you palliative care. We're not even going to tell the family. We're just going to do what we want to do. Is that really going on?
Yes.
Oh,
every day. At least at our hospital it is. They don't consider the quality of life issue with the patient. And they're, like I said, they're not giving them the options that they need to have. The people will come in with a DNR status. But that doesn't mean do not treat either. You know, for some people, they don't want the heavy-duty chest compressions and the intubation, things like that. But that doesn't mean they don't want to survive and try to get home with some of the limited and simple things that we might be able to do for them to get them through their ordeal. So I have seen where, and I'm on the ethics committee at our hospital as well, but I have seen doctors and insurance organizations step in and say, no, this is what the advance directive said 20 years ago, and we are going to adhere to that. And despite the fact that it might say that a son or a daughter or a relative has now the power of attorney to make decisions for that patient, the hospital will say, no, you don't. This is what it says, and we're strictly going to adhere to it, and we're going to usurp your power of decision-making from you that your loved one has given that relative, and we're going to usurp it from you and just say, you're done. You're going into hospice, palliative care, and you're out of the hospital, which saves them money. The public, just Elena, doesn't understand. That's the end point attempt of the administrations to get rid of these patients. And our senior patients who are on Medicare, they are paid by the government, by Medicare, for a certain length of time. It's called a DRG. And that DRG, if it's going to be too long, will not supposedly give the hospital enough money to cover their costs. And, you know, I empathize with that. I understand, you know, you can't go into bankruptcy. But I also know that these hospitals are making lots of money now, lots of money.
Yeah.
And I don't think that fear of bankruptcy, especially our community hospital going into bankruptcy, is going to happen. So, yes, I've seen the patients come in with certain documents, but I've seen also the organizations surrounding those patients, the insurance companies, Medicare, and even especially the hospital, saying, no, we're interpreting this legally, and we're going to take your rights away and put grandma onto hospice care and get you out of this hospital dead.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today, my guest is Dr. Gene Doreo, a practicing physician in California. And I wanted to actually ask you, Gene, I know that California is one of the states that's passed a physician-assisted suicide legislation. And I read something today that's really disturbing. A patient who has scleroderma, which is an autoimmune disease that has a shortened lifespan associated with it. So she states that when she was, before this law passed, that she was being treated to prolong her life. I told her she had 2 years to live, and she's now lived four. And they were going to give her a new state-of-the-art treatment, and it was being, of course, reviewed by the insurance company. You know how that goes.
Yep.
Then the law was passed, and then the insurance company came back pretty quickly and said, we're not covering it. So they denied her coverage based on and she believes it's because this assisted suicide law passed, which makes it easier and cheaper to offer someone that as opposed to actually taking care of them. So the gist of the article was that she asked the insurance company, well, what if I wanted to have my doctor help me commit suicide? And they're like, sure, we'll cover that. And the cost of the drugs are about $1.50. I mean, it was like amazing. We are in a position where we've got people getting plugs pulled, potentially, all over the country, sanctioned by the government. It's ghoulish, honestly.
It honestly is. It's, you know, we developed it's called End of Life Option here in California, and it passed last November in the state legislature, and on June the 9th of this year it was enacted, which allows us to, as physicians, to assist our patients should they have a terminal illness. And I have not had a patient yet who has gone through this, but I have been asked by several patients about this particular option. So because of that, I looked at the material that one needs to go through and fill out and jump through the hoops. And, you know, these are out to safeguard against manipulation, especially by insurance companies, which I think is good. But there's still, you know, the insurance companies, the hospitals, they have attorneys that look for loopholes. And I'm sure they're going to find loopholes in this, which will push some of the patients into an arena where they won't get the care that they need because the costs are being saved by the hospital or the insurance company. So the end point of treatment should not be termination of the patient. But, you know, this seems to be happening in our country, and it's sanctioned by government allowing not only this to occur, but regulatory agencies ignoring some of the red flags that are going up right now.
Well, it's also... it's encouraged. So if Medicare pays for end-of-life discussions, but they won't pay for a hip replacement, what message does that send to a patient and their family? And, you know, using it's psychological warfare, too, for, I'm sure, a senior, you know, head of a family to say, I don't want my family to struggle. I don't want my family to suffer. I'll just take, you know, I hate to put it in a vernacular, but take one for the team. Because I think I'm doing something to help my family. This is all emotional blackmail.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I see that every day. This is how they ply the palliative care into the ICU setting. Oh, the patient is suffering. Oh, the patient is in pain. Oh, we have to put them out of their misery. Because my patients come in and I tell them, you are going to be suffering. You are going to be in pain. You are ill. You know, patients aren't rolled into the hospital saying, lolly, lolly, get me well, put an IV in me, and I'm going to get better. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. They are suffering, but the hospitals take advantage of that emotion and throw it at the patient and their family and say, no, we can't do any more. And then the public doesn't know, but the potential options that could be given to the patient are not, just so the patient is driven in a certain direction, family is driven in a certain direction to make decisions that the hospital wants and that is not for the good of the patient. That's where decision-making has been removed from the physician and their hands and put it into administrative hands for the administrators to guide them in a direction and make sure that their costs are minimized and their profits are elevated.
Now, I understand, and we're talking shorthand, but give my listeners an example of what you mean so they can actually see a nuts and bolts example of that.
Well, I have a good example of how a patient had nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and was admitted to the emergency room. And lab testing was done, and then a CAT scan of the abdomen was done. And the CAT scan revealed what was reported by the radiologist as metastatic carcinoma of the liver.
Mm-hmm.
And the patient was immediately put on palliative, and then the hospice team came in, even into the emergency room, to place the patient on a morphine drip with a Foley catheter put in. And the family, even before they got there, all of these things took place. And as it turns out, the patient didn't have metastatic cancer. A biopsy was done, which was found to be negative. And not only that, even in the era of EMRs with computerization, the hospital had a previous CAT scan of the abdomen, which showed the changes in the liver, but that was in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So here it was 2014 or so, and these changes were there. But yet the hospital jumped immediately in an emergency room setting to place the patient on hospice. And why do I tell you this story? Because it was our mother. This was our mother who lives at home. She's going to be 95 next month, and she lives at home on her own with her cats, takes care of her garden, and they declared her before my brother, and my brother is a physician also. He got to the emergency room first, and he said, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And he jumped on them, and I got there after that, and we both said, you know, what you're doing is inappropriate. Now, they didn't know that we were physicians at the time. But my brother and I both are hospice palliative physicians, and we knew right away what they were attempting to do. But this is what goes on at hospitals. This is the interjection of their wants and needs of making money mm-hmm. against our patients. The public just doesn't know this, and I know every day in the United States and even in our community, this is going on where examples of our patients being pushed in a certain direction, being told certain things or not told certain things, are being psychologically abused, and their loved ones are lined up toward hospice care and palliative and then hospice care. To me, Elena, it's a scourge that should be revealed to the public, but yet is not. And that's our example. That's our family example. But I know it's happening all the time.
I absolutely agree. I my dad was almost a victim of the same thing. And I think this is how the direction of the healthcare system is moving towards a socialized system. He lived outside the country in a place where socialized medicine is the standard and the norm. He was 89 years old at the time, in his garden with his pets, totally with it, no problem. All of a sudden he has nausea and vomiting. He gets admitted to the hospital, and they didn't manage him. They let him throw up daily for a couple of weeks until he dropped to about 90 pounds. And I was trying to, of course, I came back into the country, but you couldn't get a doctor on the phone. There's no paging system. Wow. They basically wanted to warehouse my dad. He was in the farthest room with four other seniors dying slowly. I literally had to take him out, put him in a private setting, and pay for him to have surgery, which he came through swimmingly, off a vent in 24 hours, dancing at his 90th birthday. So he would have been dead had they decided to just, I'm not going to do anything. Because I actually asked the doctor, well, what are you going to do? He's got an obstruction. Nothing. So, I mean, they told me, and I'm a physician, so imagine what would happen if you don't have a physician right. family member. How many people get slow walked or fast walked to their end because nobody is their advocate? And when we're going to take a break, and I want to come back and talk about, because people are going to go, well, how can doctors let this happen? But there's a reason. So we're going to talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose, and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're having a really important and enlightening conversation with Dr. Jean Doreo about what happens when you enter the hospital system. And we've talked about Medicare patients. We've talked about patients with life-threatening illnesses. And the question I'm sure that people are going to ask, Jean, is, well, if this is going on, why aren't doctors up in arms and stopping this? But there's a reason. And, you know, we're talking about sham peer review. We're talking about the power of the medical executive committee, whatever you want to call those guys. What can the average doctor who's working in a hospital or seeing their patients in a hospital, why can't they be more proactive and say, I'm stopping this, I'm putting my foot down, this is not going on? Because there's a reason.
They're afraid. They're afraid they have their foot in a practice that now pays their mortgage. It allows them to give their kids a college education. They've established themselves, and, of course, the hospital knows this. So the physicians are afraid because their financial their finances are jeopardized. They're being dangled. Some of them sign contracts with the hospital. They're part of a medical group. They sign contracts. Some of them have been given monies to be established there. You know, some of them have close-in ties with being directors paid for by the hospital, and they don't want to be cut off from that. So those are being threatened. But the other side of the coin is the manipulation that is taking place at every hospital. And you mentioned sham peer review, which is the tip of the iceberg. You know, it all starts from the top. It starts where the legal loopholes have been found by administrators to be able to take control of all aspects, which ultimately ends up in medical decision-making against our patients. But when you have a board of directors that is conflicted financially, that is, all their votes, and it's all related to votes. We know that. A board of directors have votes, and if you are compromising those votes by giving contracts to those board of directors, that's a problem. And when you have regulatory agencies and oversight agencies who know that this is occurring, and even if for our hospital, a nonprofit hospital, which is under the auspices, it's a 501c3 under the auspices of the IRS, even though the IRS knows about it, they still let it go. So when you have a board of directors that is now making some of the rules against the physicians are going to quiver and not do, not stand out and be whistleblowers. With me, I've been allowed to be a whistleblower because I don't have directorships. I don't have contracts with the hospital. You know, they didn't bring me in. I've been in the community for almost three decades. Mm-hmm. So they don't have that control over me. But the other doctors fear too much, and they won't stand up. I see it every day at our hospital where doctors know something is going on, know something is taking place, know that it's ethically and morally corrupted, but they don't want to make an attempt to change that. Why is that? Well, to me, that's almost a violation of our Hippocratic Oath. It's almost a violation of our own personal moral code and compass. We're moving in the wrong direction on that, and they know that, but yet, because of financial compromise, they live in fear. So they will not, Elena, they will not stand up. And that's why I think that for us as physicians, the changes that we are looking for are not going to take place through the doctors. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be the ones that do it. I think we, though, as physicians who are in the hospital setting, can enlighten the patients on what is going on, can be the advocate for those patients who are in need of us, and help them understand what is going on. And that's why I write my blog. That's why I try to get this out into the community. But the problem is, when they have millions of dollars to go against physicians and fight them on this, they will win this battle. But, you know, you have to find those brave people out there, which I have done, to try to get them to hear, the public to hear what is going on. And that's the hard part. The doctors will not be the advocates. They will not be the ones who bring this to the and force issues here. It's going to be the public, and the doctors have to get them on their side in some way or another. And, you know, that's why I and many other bloggers write about this.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's about the doctor-patient alliance. Patients have more power than they know, than they even know. And it's just like the whole country is going in the same direction, where we have all these interests, these muddied interests, entrenched interests, who have no interest in having the system change, because it's a moneymaker. It's a control issue. And if patients and voters, everybody, which we're just withdrawing our consent, and we're not having this anymore, and it stops now, it would stop. You know, I mean, ultimately, they are gaming the system. You just described part of what goes on in a doctor's mindset who's on a payroll, who's getting money from the hospital. To me, that is the worst seeding of your own individual power that you can possibly have. I don't take money from any hospital. I see patients as a consult, but I don't want them to control me. And the movement of our profession has been towards becoming indentured servants, where you're getting a paycheck just to feel safe. But the flip side is what you just described. They run you. They own you. And if you step outside the box, you've got sham peer review. And for those that don't know exactly what that is, that means somebody can bring a charge against a doctor anonymously. They can slander you, they can lie about you, and they can't, in Maine, you can't even be sued. If you knowingly tell a lie about a physician to get them into trouble, get them peer reviewed, their law states that's free game. You can't sue them. You can't go after the person. That is ridiculous. What kind of system is that?
Yeah, but see, Elena, it's not only corrupted in the way you're talking about, but it's manipulated, and the attorneys and hospital administrators have come together to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do they go after you with sham peer review, they also go after you with code of conduct. They also go after you for corrective action. They also go after you if you're on a hospital medical staff, your reappointment. For instance, at our hospital, and I think at every hospital, you get reappointed every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you have to reapply and put your application as, and I think that's a good thing to do, because you want to make sure things haven't occurred that could be detrimental to the care of the patients in the hospital. But sometimes, though, they use that as a tool to twist somebody's arm. For instance, the best example is myself. This 2-year reapplication, for the past almost 4 years now, I've had to apply for reappointment every 4 months.
Wow.
Every 4 months, 3 times a year. All my colleagues, 1 time every 2 years. Mine is every 4 months. Why is that? Because I'm a whistleblower, and because they want to tell me that they've got control, and they want to tell me that your privileges at the hospital may be in jeopardy. That's their little sign to me that hey, Dr. Dorio, you might be a whistleblower, but we're going to be able to cut your throat as soon as we can, and we're going to go after you. And they have sent my charts out for outside people to look at, inside people to look at, to see how they can get me off staff. They have not been successful at that. And, of course, I have found the legal ways. I have a repertoire of 18 attorneys that I have on my cell phone that I can call up immediately for information to help me out in fighting them. So doctors are afraid. We're all afraid. The whole system, you want an alliance of patients and doctors together charging forward,
mm-hmm,
against the problems that we are seeing right now. But to be honest with you, I'm not sure what the power that these folks have right now, if we're going to be able to stop this. It's really going to take a uniform group to come together to say enough is enough, and I don't know if we have that, Elena, right now.
I think we're moving that way. And
I hope so.
I think so. I mean, you have Physicians Organizing Committee, which we'll talk about in the next segment, because that to me, and I've joined as a member of that as well, where you have an entity that has the doctor-patient, you know, well-being in mind. And it's not about the money. It's about the right thing to do, which is really powerful. You have the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. You have a lot of groups, you know, what is it, the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. A lot of things are now coming together where they've pushed the envelope so far where it's so expensive that people can barely afford to even pay for the premiums, let alone actually seek medical care, that it's now become not theoretical anymore. It's real. Next year is going to be a wake-up call for everybody in this country.
Great.
And they're going to be waking up to 80% increase in premiums and just astronomical out-of-pocket costs. And they're going to start to pay attention at that point. We've been telling this for, I've been doing it for 7 or 8 years now, and it's like you're talking to a brick wall, but now it's not. So this is our avenue now to take our power back. You're a pioneer. You see patients and you keep them out of the hospital, which is great. I say starve the beast. Stay healthy. Stop getting in a position where the hospital, you have to be in a hospital as much as you possibly can. As a physician, I'm a surgeon. I do 99% of my work now in my office. I'm not giving the hospital any money so they can gouge my patients and me at the same time. So by, you know, getting rid of their financial power over us, by keeping it in our office, by doing direct primary care, by doing house calls, starve the beast. And ultimately, they'll always get people to come in. I'm sure the medical schools are now warehouses for people who think that way. It's this whole mindset of, I got mine, the seniors got theirs, their time is over, and it's this mindset of they're costing everybody too much money. I've never heard medical students talk like this until recently.
Yep.
But we're in a position now where I read on one of your blogs about being a two-tier system.
Mm-hmm.
It is a two-tier system. If you take your power back and go to doctors like yourself or me or any other doctor who has the fiduciary responsibility to you, the patient, the Hippocratic Oath is the centerpiece of their training and their treatment, and we start getting patients who get it, they're going to have to come to us, and they're going to have to raise their standard because they're not going to be able to gouge everybody. They can't make you go to the hospital and get sick, right? At least not at this point.
Yeah.
So I'm optimistic, actually, that we can win this thing. And on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Dr. Doreo, you and I both belong to Physicians Organizing Committee, which is a real grassroots organization. For my listeners, tell me exactly how you found it and how it's been helping you.
Well, I did a teleconference, I think it was a year and a half ago or so, that my doctor's practice. It was in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
So I was listening there, and I heard a gentleman named Jeff Wilson, who is from Physicians Organizing Committee. And, you know, he's here in California where I am, and we've been having trouble at our hospital and getting nowhere. But so many physicians were trying to fight the administration at our hospital, but then it ended up where just very few of us, and a gentleman named Dr. Gregory Jenkins, who is former chief of staff, was still continuing the battle with myself, and we decided that we would look into the Physicians Organizing Committee. And when we, the same simultaneous week that we traveled up to San Francisco to meet with Jeff Wilson, a group of doctors, the Medical Executive Committee at Tulare Regional Medical Center, was removed from staff. And we brought that to the attention of the Physician Organizing Committee, and they didn't know about it because it was new off the press. A meeting was arranged in Tulare with other physicians there, and the physicians there were like, "Who are you? What are you doing? Where are you coming from?" And it was so interesting because it was doctors coming from Southern California, Northern California, to meet in Middle State of Tulare, California, to talk about the problems that they were having there. And the physician organizing committee organized a protest, a rally, the public coming in, and there was a vote going on with the hospital of the public vote, and the physician organizing committee had influence on that and got denied the monies that they were trying to usurp from the public to build a hospital, which most of that money was paid by taxpayers, which would not be held accountable. So the physician organizing committee, for me, started off on a huge, giant leap that said to me, gee, there is hope. There are people out there that are attempting to try to rectify this problem and make it clear to the public that that we are not being cared for medically, that we have a lot of things we need to do right now to force these issues to make sure that the public gets good health care. So there are many other organizations other than Physician Organizing Committee. Mm-hmm. And Elena, my hope is that we can bring these organizations together with a common purpose, a common goal, across political lines, across financial lines, and bring it to the public with a public alliance with us, mm-hmm. and say, hey, we need to move forward with this and not succumb to the poor care that we're getting right now. As I write in my blogs all the time, that we as a nation without good health care will not be able to compete in the world marketplace. Our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will not be able to compete in the world marketplace if we don't have health care. So that's, I think, I hope, as physicians try to come together, that we bring that alliance together as well, so that the public understands where we all need to go and we all have direction to this.
I absolutely agree. It's not a left or a right thing. It's about doing the right thing for your patient. Correct. And to have the physicians who are advocates. That's our profession. We are healers. We're not gatekeepers. We're not people who perform euthanasia. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. It's about healing people. And in the last, we have about 5 minutes or so left, I wanted to talk about briefly, because people don't know this either, we are no longer the front line of care. They've sidelined us, whether they're handcuffing us because they want to control us by how we treat the patient. But I read one of your blogs about the nurse practitioners and the doctor nurses, nurses of doctoring, I'm sorry, nursing, I've got to try. Doctorate of Nursing,
physician assistants and nurse practitioners.
They are the front line now, and they have a different mentality. They're being used, aren't they, to get the palliative care, to decide who goes into hospice. It's not the physicians anymore in some instances, is it?
No, it's not. First of all, I know many nurse practitioners and physician assistants who are excellent. They do a super job. Many of them should be physicians, but because of the system, because of the cost, because of the time, they have not been able to move forward into a MD arena, but they have taken on the chore of being nurse practitioners and PAs. And I think they have done just many of them an excellent job, but their role as the front line of care has been more pronounced, and it's because, of course, their pay is less, their education is less, their pay is less, so they're going to be used in situations where maybe a doctor should be seeing the patient instead. What my fear is, you're a surgeon, that some of the patients will be having surgery done by PAs and MPs, and that will become acceptable, and to me, that is not acceptable. So these are the fears that we have. But going to your question about palliative care and hospice care, yes, sometimes decisions are being made not only by nurse practitioners and PAs, but by nurses in general and maybe social workers, discharge planners, case managers. They're the ones who are sometimes being advocating in a direction that the patient should not be going, and that is hospice, palliative or hospice care. And that is something at a level of decision-making that only doctors should do, not those at nurse practitioner, PA, or nursing level. Those decisions should be made by physicians, but it's being taken out of the hands of physicians by policies being made by the hospital core of the board of directors. This is what's happening in America right now, and people just do not understand that. It is to a degree a lesser or maybe inferior care, although some of them, like I said, provide great care. But at the level of end of life, physicians need to be the decision makers because of the potential for manipulation of what's going on now, of profiteers and hospital administrators taking advantage and finding the loopholes their lawyers have helped them with to get our patients off their payroll so they can make more money.
Well, it's a direct conflict of interest.
And absolutely.
You talked about end of life, but I understand also that nurse practitioners and physician assistants are running ICUs. That is a critical care physician. That is a super specialty within anesthesia, within internal medicine, etc. A 2-year training does not equal a critical care physician in any stretch of the imagination. And I've talked to nurses who quit the profession because they were being put in an unsafe position where they were putting in lines and deciding critical care issues in an ICU. It's completely unacceptable for a hospital to put patients on the line to save a buck.
And that's what they're doing. They're not only saving a buck, but they're making money off of that. And that the public needs to know this, and they don't know this at this point. And we as physicians, I think it's our responsibility to get this out there.
I'm so happy you're on my show because everything that you say is so key. I want, in the last couple of minutes that we have, how can people find your blog? How can they read more about what you're doing?
Well, I've been blogging for about a year and a half. It's called SCV Physician Report, and SCV stands for Santa Clarita Valley. That's where my home is. It's north of Los Angeles, about 30 miles. We're a small community, but it's called SCV Physician Report. And I always, try to find the aspects of life that concern my seniors. What I initially wanted to write about was seniors in general, their lives, their battles, and how they made it through. But it turned out to be a blog of advocacy, and for those, I value comments, and whether they're positive or negative, I value them. So when I write on SCV Physician Report, my hope is that I get worthy comments that help us think of other ideas and how we can push forward, all of us, in taking care of the public and the seniors in our community.
I thank you for your help and for your yeoman's work, and I really would hope that you can come back on the show because there's so many things that we didn't talk about, things like diagnosing brain death and some of your what you think can be done now to stop this process from happening. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Doria. You're a blessing, and
it's a
pleasure to be in the fight with you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time, and thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.